I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Alex Merrill. Welcome to The Inspirati. I've enlisted a roster of ultra-talented international creators and curators to join me on this podcast to talk about how they've charted their individual paths, overcome challenges, and found their true artistic selves. From candid conversations with eminent makers to showcasing exciting up-and-comers across the industries of art, music, fashion, entertainment, literature, and design, we get to illuminate our perspectives, learning from these unique stars within the constellation of global creativity. The Inspirati was created for those seeking inspiration and those seeking to inspire. Thanks for listening. Even if you only glance at the work of LA-based painter Andy Dixon, it doesn't come as a shock that his first aesthetic-based love was color. When he chose socks as a child, the stripes on each would contrast. When his brothers were playing video games, he was looking at the ways the colors interacted in the graphics. The fact that by the age of 12, he was starting a music career, moving from metal to punk rock, touring during summer break, and getting flack from other students for negging their school on TV also makes sense. Andy is every bit the colorful punk, asking, or perhaps answering the question, what does a Renaissance painting look like under a pop culture lens? His work frequently references classical art, but in doing so, opens up a conversation about luxury and pokes fun at the notion that while art is soul-stirring and life-affirming, it also needs to carry a price tag. A few years ago, in a true demonstration of pop culture stars aligning, Versace reached out, over Instagram DM no less, to have Andy create an installation for Salone del Mobile, the furniture fair in Milan. This led to a fashion collaboration for spring 2020, a true meeting of the minds between two creative forces that are fearless with color, historical references, and general over-the-topness. Along his journey from high school outsider to art world insider, Andy has made peace with an important concept. You don't need to be niche to be noteworthy. You don't need to make inexplicable art to make great art. You can make things people enjoy and involve them in a dialogue without selling out, whatever that really means. In fact, it might be braver not to always expect rejection, but to open yourself up to acceptance. I caught up with Andy as he was preparing to open his latest exhibit, Masterpieces, which is on view until April 18th at Over the Influence in Los Angeles. We talked about the terrible physical effects of not quitting your day job, the real definition of meta, and the perks of letting go of branding yourself an outcast to join the great conversation. I hope our chat adds a pop of color to your day. Please enjoy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Congrats on a great 24 hours by the looks of it on Instagram.
Thanks. Yeah, we're just sort of doing just having some friends by. The show is still officially not open, but it's also totally booked to go see it. So it's my only chance to get my friends to see it, just to sneak in early while we're still hanging it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Thank you.
Well, greetings from your hometown. When was the last time you were in Vancouver?
I think it was for my dad's 70th birthday, which was, a while ago, I guess, with COVID. It kind of sliced a year out of all of our lives. So I guess it's been a couple of years.
Pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
The old world.
Yep.
So crazy. What do you miss about Canada and what do you not miss?
I miss healthcare.
Yeah.
not being worried that I'm going to hurt my foot and have to pay $10,000.
The bane of the creative experience in the US, right?
Yeah, exactly. I miss the air. I mean, every time I come back and I get off the plane and YVR, do you take in that first lung full of like piney air, alpine air? It is, it's unbeatable.
It's so unique, isn't it?
It really is.
When I was living in New York, I remember coming back to Vancouver to visit my family, and it would be like I hadn't breathed.
Exactly.
In 6 months or whatever.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, have I had oxygen in my body in a year?
Your body's like, I don't know how to compute this.
Yeah, so that's... those. I mean, I miss my friends, my family, of course. I had a great network there. I was there for so long. It's kind of like, I don't know, Vancouver is that funny thing where it's like, the city is that perfect size where it's a city, but it's also kind of a small town in another way. And if you're there long enough, you sort of know everybody, you know, the person who, you know, the server at the restaurant, and then you go into the art store and you know everybody there.
Yeah.
You know, the guy that makes your stretchers, you know, you walk down the street, you meet it, you know, see everybody, you know, it's like very Gilmore Girls or something.
Stars Hollow.
I miss that. I miss knowing everybody, you know, but at the same time, it's cool to be in LA where you're a little more anonymous, and you know, I'm getting a pretty strong network of friends here, but it's never going to be like that because Vancouver has that smallness to it, which is quaint or something.
You know? Totally. Totally. So according to Wikipedia, you're the son of two accountants. Is that correct?
No, that's actually not that right. I should sign up for Wikipedia. You know what? Actually, I had to sign up for a wiki account to change my own birthday because it was wrong on my wiki page.
Who wrote it wrong?
I don't know. Who knows? Yeah, it was the wrong year. It said I was born in 1980, not 1979. And then when I tried to change it, it was like, cite a reference to prove this. And I was like, but I'm me. I don't know.
You're like, can I send you my passport? How about that?
So my dad is an accountant, full CGA, has been since before I was born. And my late mother was like his, I guess, assistant sort of secretary, so bookkeeper for a while. So it's a bit of a misnomer. She was not an accountant. She just did like bookkeeping for him sometimes.
Family business.
Family business.
That's nice.
Over the family business, unfortunately. I have two brothers and none of us want to be accountants. So I don't know.
Business. Do they do cross-border? I feel like that would have been really helpful as you were figuring to come to the States. I'm like trying to figure all that out right now, and it's like such a hassle.
Oh really? Yeah, I have a immigration lawyer that I talked to. Yeah, she's perfect. Amazing. If you want, I'll send you her contact. She's incredible.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I might need that at some point. So did you love making art as a kid, or was music the first spark?
That's a good question. It was both. I mean, I think if I really went back all the way to like, you know, toddler, 6, 7 to 10 kind of thing, definitely visual art. I was like obsessed with drawing. I don't know any more than any other kid. I think all kids do that. I don't know if I'm romanticizing it now because of how it turned out. But I mean, I definitely loved it more than my two older brothers who loved sports, video games. And I really only watched them play video games because I liked the graphics. Like, I liked the way the colors looked. So I think I was drawn to visual art, like visual, like representation of things and like color matching things. I loved like, you know, the old like 70s or 80s white socks with the like different color stripes at the end.
Yeah.
I'd like mix and match them to like, the green stripe one looks really cool with the purple one or whatever. So I've always, I don't know, just drawn to color and visual art. And then around 10, I really got into music. I discovered like Metallica and just went down the metal rabbit hole for the next long time. And then that turned into like punk music and experimental stuff and got really into that. And visual art definitely took like a back seat from then on for a long time. And I was definitely trying to be like a professional musician.
You were like a proper guitar player before you were a teenager, weren't you?
Oh, I could shred. I could shred, yeah. I was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, I was in bands that like toured and stuff. We had records out. I mean, it's not like it was a hobby. It's like all I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a hobby in that there was no monetary value in it, but...
Right. Yeah. You guys were on TV. You were on like Much Music and stuff, right? Was that while you were in high school?
Yeah. Yeah. We played the Much Environment in in high school. Yeah, interviewed by Sukin Lee on, what was the name of the punk show? The Wedge? I think it was The Wedge.
Maybe. I didn't watch the punk show. I was like watching stuff that is too embarrassing to mention, but I loved Much Music as a kid, so I remember. What was that like when you were going to school? Because you guys were blowing up.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, every summer vacation or summer holiday off of school was spent like touring. It'd be like 3 months in a van driving around America or Europe. It was kind of, it's hard to describe. It was like cool, but it was also, there was something weird about it in that, like, I don't think we were very good at garnering the support of our peers. Like, we considered ourselves more outcasts than we probably were, if that makes any sense. Like, I think if we had been a little more friendly and open to like other people in our school, that we'd actually be kind of like superstars in that school. But we were probably, from other people's perspective, we looked like snobs that were on Much Music, so we didn't want to talk to anybody. But in our heads, it was probably more like a result of just like a lot of bullying before that, and so it was sort of more like, you know, leave us alone, we don't belong in the school thing. So it's not like there was like parties in the high school hallways where it was high-fiving us and like, oh,
so it wasn't like She's All That.
Yeah, it was not a She's All That moment. I didn't take my glasses off and was suddenly super hot. I do even remember this one time during the Much Music interview, one of the questions was about our high school, and we kind of like shit on it a little bit. Not in any way that we were super intentional, just kind of, I don't remember what was said. One of us said something about how it was like, you know, there's a lot of people that were pretty mean to us in school. And I remember specifically coming back and walking through the halls of the high school, and someone was like, I can't believe you were dissing our school on TV.
Oh my God.
So it was sort of weird. It wasn't like, wasn't probably what you'd imagine if you thought about like being pseudo famous in high school.
Do you think that has anything to do with Canadian culture? Because I've only been back for a year, and a lot of that tall poppy syndrome conversation comes up about Canada and about people not necessarily embracing those who are super ambitious.
So true. It's so true. I'm not sure I totally agree that it's a Canadian thing. To me, it really feels like a Vancouver thing.
Vancouver
has this kind of like...
Yeah.
Salty seaside town vibe where, like, I mean, I love it, and you know, it's my home forever. I'll be buried there. I'll go back. But there is this kind of like, you know, that scene in American Werewolf in London when like they're first looking for the werewolf, and they're like, they're going around like small town, I think they're in Scotland, and they like go into this tiny bar, like this little pub, Scottish pub, and like everyone like stops and stares at them, and they're all like playing darts and smoking, and they're like, who the hell are you? That's to me what Vancouver kind of feels like. And there is this kind of like, and I get why it's, I think it, a lot of it has to do with like a lack of resources. Like, it's not an abundance of resources, so everyone's eager to share, like, oh, I found the coolest new bar. It's kind of like, I found this bar, there's only one of them, I need to protect it, kind of.
Yeah.
I get it. I was like that. I mean, I'm fully guilty of having that vibe around me in Vancouver, I think. I didn't even know it, but looking back, I think I probably did. But yeah, it kind of also turns into this, like, if you're trying too hard, it's like a little corny or something. It's corny to be ambitious or sort of. It's weird. And I've never been able to fit in perfectly because of that. Or like hide my ambition. I mean, I think a lot of the music we were making could have turned out differently, but we were almost like trying to fail in a weird subconscious way because then it would still be cool. I don't know. It's like, it's a whole,
that's interesting.
Very strange. Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading an article about this girl I know in the Vancouver Sun recently, and they were talking about how she, you know, she mentioned she is currently running four companies, and it was like, I'm running for a company, she says, without even a hint of bragging. And the whole article was about how the most impressive thing about her is she's not taking excessive pride in what she's doing. And it was just like so strange. It felt really... Yeah.
Why? What is that about? Why?
I don't know.
What's the problem with taking pride in like in your life and like what you're trying to do, like the way you're trying to express yourself creatively or the job you have or how, you know, it's very strange. I don't quite get it. Yeah.
I kind of want to contribute to the back push against that, because I feel like, you know, part of it is Canadians not wanting to be too American.
Yeah, exactly. That
but
is part.
I think in that focus, we're kind of missing opportunities to develop our own culture and not care about who we're like or any of that, because we're just doing our own thing and we don't care.
Exactly. That's a funny thing about Canadian identity, is that it's not that clear on what Canada is, except that it's definitely not America. That's like the identity of Canada. Like, I'm not sure what we are, but we're definitely not those other guys.
I argue this in a social studies paper in like the 11th grade, and my teacher like gave me a bad mark because he disagreed with me, and I was like, this sucks. Like, come on, man. He was like, hockey, man. Hockey's our identity. I was like, oh,
fair enough.
I need to move.
Yeah. Touché.
So you did music from like 11, 12 until what age?
Yeah, good question. So it kind of fizzled out, I guess. So it's not like there was a day I was like, okay, I'm done. Well, pretty close actually, but it was already doing quite poorly by then. But I mean, to go back to relate it to what we were just talking about, I mean, I got really down the rabbit hole of like obscure esoteric type of music. Probably because a little bit of that Vancouver vibe, right? Like, it's almost like a form of self-protection where, like, if you don't look like you're trying that hard, then if someone doesn't like it, well, you weren't trying that hard.
You didn't fail. So yeah.
You didn't really fail that hard. So I think, like, by the time I was maybe in my mid-20s, I was making music that virtually no one could enjoy, probably intentional. I mean, I just got into really experimental stuff. I got into noise stuff and sound collage, and I wanted to make music that had never been heard before. I mean, it's equally ambitious and not ambitious at all. It's kind of a weird, it's hard to describe.
You weren't trying to relate at that point.
I wasn't trying to relate at all. It was definitely my own thing, my own world I was in. I knew what I liked from some of the experimental stuff I was into, and I was trying to like push those boundaries. And listening back, it's like pretty wild stuff. Yeah. And then it just kind of turned into casually playing in bands from there.
Right.
A few of my friends' bands, I would like just for fun, just like something to do. Yeah.
Was that all in Vancouver?
Yeah, totally.
Cool.
Yeah. And then probably stopped completely around, I don't know, I'd guess like 30.
Okay.
Probably like the last show I ever played. If I don't even know what it is, but I'm sure I was maybe 28, 30, something like that.
And did you leap directly from music back into art, or did you ever have a job?
I did once. I was going through a real existential moment where I was realizing that music wasn't going to do anything. From that experimental point of making music, I actually started to try. I got more into like mainstream rap personally. So I started getting into more mainstream music and realizing that I've been kind of a fool for writing off pop culture so hard. So I definitely got into more mainstream stuff, and I started producing stuff and doing like remixes. And I thought maybe I could kind of spring back into, because I was good at like the actual sonic. Even though the music I was making was super experimental, it still was like mixed well. It had like a balance. You know, I knew how to make a song sound good. I'm an okay producer. Spent like since I was 12 in the studio. So I kind of get how it works. So I was like, oh, maybe I can do some, you know, some remixes and stuff. I did that for a while. And yeah, right around then I sort of started to have a real existential slip and not realize, like, I was like, oh my God, I'm turning 30 and I don't know what I'm doing. This like music thing is obviously not work. I spent about 20 years on this. And so I did get a job as a graphic designer and at a firm. So all this whole time, I'm also making music in my 20s. I'm also doing graphic design to pay the bill.
Just freelancing?
Yeah, freelancing for like basically other musicians.
Okay.
So whenever any of my bands would, you know, put out a record, have a t-shirt or make a website, I would be the one that would do it just because I loved doing visual art. And then other people would see that and be, oh, I love your album cover. And then I kind of accidentally had this whole graphic design career of like other bands and like-minded kind of musicians contacting me to do their stuff. And maybe not just only music, but I did some kind of random freelance stuff, like a construction company or whatever.
But this was the first time that you like had a boss.
Yeah, I had a desk job. I had like a cubicle desk job. Yeah, it was, I lasted 9 months until I swear to God, I threw up at my desk from the stress of it and quit on the spot.
No.
I could not do it. I am not wired that way. I saw the project manager which I didn't even know what that was for the first 9 months I worked there. I saw her coming over and like, she was just so mean. And or she, I guess she wasn't mean. It's just that like our form of communication was so, we just did not know how to talk to each other. And the only time she'd ever come over is for like a pushback from a client on something I needed to do, like make the logo bigger, some bullshit. It's not like even like creative things, you know? And yeah, I saw her come over and I was like, I'm gonna throw up. I ran to the bathroom and then I came back. I was like, this is not for me. I gotta quit.
That's amazing. Well, if barfing at work doesn't push you into like really exploring your creativity, I don't know what would.
And like the next day I got an art studio and like was like, okay, I think this is what I need to do. I mean, I was thinking all along, I just wasn't taking it very seriously, but.
And it was bad for your health.
Yeah, exactly. So when I quit that job, I really buckled down on painting. That's when I like really started to, I quit all the bands, I quit my job, and I got an art studio at the Waldorf Hotel, and I started painting.
And what did that early work look like? And how do you feel about that now?
I like it. I'm happy with it, actually. You can tell it's like work. I mean, every artist goes through that period where they're sort of, you know, trying things. You know, obviously it wasn't going to be, first painting wasn't going to be a masterpiece, but
yeah.
I like looking back on the work of artists that I respect and to see how they got there. And it's interesting to see that journey. Like I can see it doesn't look like the work now, but it doesn't not look like it either. You know,
you
can see where it was going for sure.
Yeah.
It was definitely cruder. I was like really into kind of abstract expressionism at the time. The work before that was like a lot of like sort of mark making and scribbles. So it had that, but I started to think like, oh, what if I took these marks and I tried to turn them into the human form? Like if it was representational.
Mm.
So the first works in at the Waldorf were those. They were sort of like reclining nudes in this like really kind of scribbly style. That I think they look pretty cool, actually.
Do you think that putting yourself out there creatively at such a young age made you a bit more resilient to like the inevitability of the fumbling process that's required to develop a personal style?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I can't speak to what it would be like to be someone else, but I can only imagine that. Like, I remember getting my first bad review for like our first album when I was like 14 or whatever. And yeah, it broke my heart. I mean, I could not even believe someone could say something like that. I was such a sensitive kid. But then 2 days later, you get over it, you laugh about it with your friends, and you are like, oh, okay, I guess this is just part of it, right? Like,
it toughens you up.
You're not making music for everybody. Not everybody's gonna get it, and not everybody's gonna think it's good. Like, art is so subjective. Of course some people are gonna think it sucks.
Yeah, totally. I was a telemarketer for one summer when I was 16, and I feel like it completely stripped me of caring when people think I suck.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that would do it.
If anything would do it, that would be it. I was like, do you want to buy this vacation rental in Mexico? And they're like, go to hell.
Yeah. You're like, okay, well, on to the next one.
Totally. Yeah, it kind of makes you more weirdly comfortable in your own skin, I think.
Well, thick skin is good to have, I think. My girlfriend is a server, and she said the same thing about, like, that's how she sort of, like, learned to develop that thick skin. It's just like just any customer service job. I don't know how you, I've never had, oh, I did. I worked at Sam the Record Man when I was like 19 or 17 or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's an easy customer service job. It's like, you're just selling Bare Naked Lady CDs to people. It's like so easy.
Yeah.
No one, it's such a clean transaction. It's not like anything surprising. They bring it to you. You know, it's not the same as bringing someone food or trying to sell someone a vacation package on the phone.
Slightly different. So you started in Vancouver and then you went to New York next, right?
I did. Right around once the art thing was doing pretty well, I had a gallery show in New York. I'm really one of those people who has a hard time making choices until an opportunity presents itself in order to make that choice.
Mm.
I'm not really a like, oh, I'll just go on vacation kind of person. It's more like, I'll wait until somebody else invites me, or like there's something I really wanted to see, or there's an inn, like, oh, my friend owns this place in Palm Springs. Like, oh, okay, I'll go.
You'll wait until you're barfing at your desk before you start your career.
I'm not very proactive with that kind of stuff. So it took me getting a show in New York to realize I should move there. So I was basically like, I'll go to New York to work on the show that I have coming up in a year. I'll spend the year working on the show there. That way it'll be more of a reflection of like my psyche while I'm in New York. And also it'll just be easy. I mean, we can schedule like studio visits with potential clients from the gallery who are in New York. So I just decided to try it out. But the only problem was that we filed for my O-1, that's like the artist visa.
Yeah.
We filed for my O-1 in kind of a weird way where it was based on the show, not on like multiple shows. And so when the show was over, the visa was up and I had to come home.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So I was only there for a year before and then I kind of realized I had to I had to leave.
Which year was that?
2015, I want to say. 2016. Okay. Yeah. And then I came home and I filed for another O-1. Which took a lot longer because right around then was when Trump got elected. So everything got all messed up and with that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so it took a long time to get the next one. And the plan was to go back to New York. But I don't know. I think I was stuck in Vancouver waiting for my O-1 to go through. And I just started thinking about like weather. I started thinking about my time in New York. I started thinking about it's like New York was so enchanting to me when I was there. I was like,
yeah,
absolutely in love. But it was almost like this, it's almost like a fiery relationship or something where like when you've taken a break from it, you're like, whoa, can I do that again?
You're like, that was a little abusive now that I think about it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I just like kind of the idea of LA started to creep in. I knew it was cheaper. I could get more space. I'm a West Coast guy. You know, there's something about the Pacific Ocean that just grounds me or something.
Totally.
Feels closer to home. So, if, you know, family, if I need to go up there for any sort of reason, it's like a $200 flight that's 3.5 hours instead of like 6 or 7 hours from New York, whatever it is.
Right.
And yeah. LA was really having like a moment at that time, I think, too, like in 2016, 17.
Didn't Freeze start right around then or later?
Maybe like 2020, maybe the first, or maybe 2019. I think it's only been two, actually. I think this was supposed to be the third one right now. Actually.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole world before COVID has been condensed in my brain. And I'm exactly. Like, did that happen 2 years ago or 17 years ago?
I know. I feel you. But I mean, to your point, like Freeze wouldn't have happened here, even though that was a little bit later. That's a sign of like what was happening in LA. You know what I mean? I think a lot of New Yorkers were getting outpriced from New York.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people from around the world were like, actually, maybe LA is the next place for artists to hang out. We can all get like, you can get like yards here and stuff, you know?
Yeah. No. Awesome. Fair enough. It's a lot more conducive to a healthy, mentally too, like a healthy lifestyle.
I think so. Yeah, you don't have to battle so hard as New York. I love New York. I'm not trying to trash talk it. There's something about that battle that's very invigorating, and I love it. And I love visiting. Ultimately, I just don't think I could handle it. I mean, I'm willing to admit that it's not New York. It's me. I don't think I could do it. I think I'm just like a little too West Coast. I was just a little too like, whoa, can we just take a little deep breath, you guys?
Yeah. You know, no, totally. I think I was only able to stay there as long. I was there for 7 years, and I think I was only able to stay there as long as I did because I left so much and came back.
Right.
And then you get there and you're basically on a treadmill the entire time you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's great when you are in a place in your life where you want to plug into that energy. But I feel like if that's not where your head's at, it would run you ragged.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't leave in the year that I was there. So yeah, it was pretty overwhelming. I remember just one of the first days there, I was just getting like a falafel or a pizza or something. I don't remember. Like there was like a little bit of a lineup, maybe 3 or 4 people. And when I got to the front of the line, I was like, hey, how's it going? Which is like, you just can't do that. They were like, what? I was like, huh? Like, what do you want? I'm like, pepperoni. And like, yeah. And they just like, don't say it. It was like, hand it to you. Like, right. Time is just so precious there, you know what I mean? Like I get totally. It. Everyone's in a rush, you know, they don't have time to ask out to answer how they're doing.
My friend Nick Haramas was on the podcast, and he is the editor-in-chief of Interview Magazine, and he was talking about how he's Canadian, and he was talking about how he has maintained his may I in spite of all the odds, and that's how he starts questions. And he's like, people don't know how to take it.
Yeah, the may I. Yeah, that would come out of left field for sure there.
Totally. So then you moved to LA.
Yeah, I got my visa, moved to LA, met my girlfriend in Vancouver in that time, in that weird time when I was trying to get to LA. So she ended up coming down with me, and we've been here for
nice. Since.
So that was maybe, I guess that was like 3 years ago.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I'm loving it. I mean, I just don't have any plans of going anywhere else at this point. It really feels like home. I think just my personality with LA's personality, it just meshed. It was a match made in heaven, I think.
Awesome.
Yeah. I really love it here. I mean, there's weird things about it. There's like, it's so spread out. There's no real city to it, which I thought I would really have a hard time adjusting to. And I get it. And another thing is that I've been coming down here for so long. That's another thing that it feels so comfortable for me, because touring bands from Vancouver, I mean, we come straight to San Francisco and LA. So I've been coming here for, you know, 20 years every year. So it's not like it felt like alienating or anything to me. But yeah, the whole aesthetic of it, like how there's no city, you know, I get that that's weird. It's like the whole feel of LA is like if cool people took over the suburbs or something, you know, like the galleries are in like mini malls, and like you can go to like a Michelin 3-star restaurant that's like beside like a Pet Cetera or something. It's really weird, and that takes some getting used to. But if you kind of turn your expectations around in your head, or like try to just view that as like actually really interesting and cool and kind of hokey and dumb, which you could see it as both, I guess.
Yeah.
But if you kind of think like, oh, this was never really a city, it's this funny Hollywood like make-believe town, and then like all these kind of cool interesting people came in and like took it over and like reinvented it and turned a mini mall into like a cool place to be, like that's kind of interesting, you know.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a modern project in itself, you know.
There's like a glorification of the outsider in that. That's interesting.
Totally. Yeah, LA is huge for that. I mean, there is no insider in LA, I'm realizing. There's no like...
Well, outside of celebrity culture.
It's, well, yeah, that, okay, yeah, that's true. But I mean, historically, it's such like a cowboy wanderer city, you know what I mean? Like, people come here to like reinvent themselves. They come here when they're lost, or they just hike and they end up here. It's kind of there's something nomadic about it, which is kind of fun. I don't know. I'm liking the energy.
Awesome. What's your studio like there?
It's gorgeous. I love it. It's in downtown LA. It's like the second floor of this essentially abandoned building. That's another thing that happens in LA that is not going to happen in New York or Vancouver.
Can you imagine?
Where square foot is so precious. People, I think, forget that they own buildings here. It seems like, I don't think the building owner even remembers he owns this building that I'm in, that my studio's in. And it's right downtown. I mean, I can't even imagine how much it would be worth, that land would be worth. But there's a whole abandoned floor in the building. It's just like a dusty, it looks like a metal music video up there. It's amazing. It's weird. It's spacious. It's huge. I got beautiful, big, beautiful windows. I love it so much.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about your process with acrylic paint and oil pastels?
Yeah. I think I always wanted to try to achieve this kind of line quality, almost like old like Warner Brothers cartoons, where the backgrounds would be these like light drawn lines on top of a dark background. And I've always been kind of obsessed with that. I think Basquiat kind of did it, you know, and I realized that what he used was oil sticks. So I got into those, like a way to kind of illustrate on top of a painting is what I've always been trying to do.
Right.
And so I developed... The way I do it is I take this acrylic paint that's mixed quite thin. So it's like the consistency of house paint. So like it's kind of watery. Well, not watery, but just thinner. And I paint with that, with the canvas on the ground, so that it dries really flat. So there's like very little brush mark. It's almost like a silk screen or something. And then I'll take my oil sticks or oil pastels once that paint is dry, and just kind of draw on top of it. It's kind of like a two-part, like paint and then illustration kind of process.
I've heard that you use your paintings as their own palettes, and you're not particularly precious about that part of the work.
Right. So I don't traditionally like mix the colors on something else and then put it on a canvas. Since the canvas is already flat down on the ground,
right,
it is a palette. So, you know, just squirt a couple of colors on there and mix it as you need it. And then where you mix the color is where the color goes, you know what I mean? I mix it on the canvas. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's very punk
Yeah, I mean, I never shook that completely for sure, even though I shed it a bit and started being more interested in like mainstream pop culture. I definitely, there's something, I can't escape just wanting to be like irreverent kind of across the board. Like I just like shaking it up, I guess, a bit, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Did you have an interest in Renaissance art or Flemish still lives, all of that, when you were younger? Or?
Not really, to be honest. Not in any kind of academic sense. I mean, I always thought that aesthetic was very beautiful. I'm more interested in seeing those works from like a pop culture perspective. I want to know what they mean to people today. Like, not any one painting, but just like, what does a Renaissance painting represent now and how is it used? Like, to me, I think of like an old, you know, drawing room in an old mansion with like chamber music playing. You know, it's got this connotation around it. It's almost like a cultural prop. And I'm interested in exploring what that means, which also asks the question, like, what does art mean as a cultural prop too? So that, I mean, that's ultimately what I'm kind of getting at. Like, do people like art because of the art, or do they like it because of what it tells the world about you?
Mm.
Because you're a collector, or I'm just interested in that, you know. I'm interested in the consumer part of the art world, and I'm interested in what paintings mean to people.
Well, and that whole time frame was really interesting, because that, to my knowledge, is kind of when a hierarchy and subject matter evolved that equated to price tags.
Right.
Where like mythological or religious works were at the top of the food chain, still lives were at the bottom, and then in between there were like genre paintings and portraits, and artists would kind of fall into this categorization of high art to low art based on their subject matter.
I didn't know that. It just goes to show that, like, I think a lot of people, or some people, might criticize today's art world for having formulas in place like that. Like the fact that some of my canvases are more because of the size, so technically it's kind of a square inch thing, but then they'll think, you know, Rubens was some kind of more pure version of art. But I personally think it's been the same. I don't think Rembrandt painted his paintings.
Right.
I mean, people criticize Jeff Koons for, like, you know, who doesn't even make his own work. I mean, I think half the work you're looking at in museums weren't painted by the person that they say.
It was like studio a lot of the time.
Yeah, and you could pay different amounts for, like, if you wanted him to like paint like one figure in there, or like the background, then you cost this much. You want to do the whole thing. It was the premium amount. So when Warhol comes up with like the factory, quote unquote, I mean, that's been happening for a lot longer than the 1980s, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of spin there.
Yeah. I'm interested in like sort of breaking down the pretension around art, you know, and like, I'm not crapping on art. I mean, obviously I love it. It's one of the most beautiful driving forces of mankind. I've been drawn to it as a kid. It's like, it's everything to me. But there's also this like business side of it that I think is at least like kind of funny. and I'm like trying to like expose it a little bit, poke fun at it a little bit, and just, yeah, break down the pretension, try to break down the mystery of the art world and make it feel like a little more approachable. I like to try to make work that quote unquote regular people, you know, people who maybe don't have a extensive background in art history would enjoy, you know?
Yeah.
But I also want it to have multi-layers where people who do have a background in art or cultural studies could enjoy it on another level, or like through a different lens.
Well, on that note, I want to talk about some of the titles of your shows. Like Expensive Things 1, Expensive Things 2, How Much Do They Cost? And my personal favorite, which I've written down, we open on Andy Dixon, vain, egotistical, materialistic, and original, sitting in a Hollywood restaurant.
That is that's a quote. It's a changed quote of from Charlie Kaufman from the movie Adaptation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm a huge Charlie Kaufman fan. I think my work deals with a similar kind of like meta art that he deals with. I mean, Adaptation was an entire movie about the making of that movie, and you're literally watching it in real time. And that was a show that like referenced myself more than any other, and I just moved to LA, so it just seemed like the right the right one. It's a, it had two self-portraits. There's only five paintings and two of them were self-portraits.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the recent Netflix documentary on Fran Lebowitz, but she talks about this bizarre public fascination on the price tags associated with specific works. And she notes that during an auction, the work comes out, nobody claps. The painting is sold for like 17 million. The hammer comes down and everybody claps, but they're clapping at the spend.
Yeah.
Not the painting.
Yeah.
You're clearly exploring the psychology around value and desire and luxury and art's relationship with money. What is your perspective on that like inescapable marriage between the two?
I'm certainly not trying to offer any answers. You know, I mean, the work asks questions and makes jokes. It's not an essay on how we get through this. I'm interested just in exploring the comedy of it, really, like, I guess the paradox of it, that work, artwork is like soul changing and also has to have a price tag is just, it's just really funny to me.
It is.
And it has to. I'm not saying it shouldn't, like, it has to. And Christie's has to exist. That's what bolsters the art market up. And that's how you know how much an artist is worth. I get it all. And I'm not even against it. But it is funny.
And it is also how artists eat, which is important.
Exactly. I need to sell work. If I could make it and give it away and we lived in some weird futuristic society where all my needs were met, then maybe I would just give it away. But I want a new pair of shoes, you know?
Yeah. Don't we all?
I need to pay my rent. You know, I got a one-bedroom apartment in LA. It's not going to pay for itself. So we live in that world. We live in capitalism. I was born and raised in capitalism. There's nothing I can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is. And I want to be as creative as possible and survive. So here we are.
Yeah. I like that you don't seem to be either deifying or vilifying luxury.
Totally. Because if I was vilifying it, I would be a hypocrite because I'm essentially making a luxury object every time I paint because the work sells for more than I can afford.
Yeah.
So who would I be if I was trying to be like, ooh, screw your kind of
screw the man.
Yeah. And I'm or like screw you trying to spend money on a very well-made art object. It's like, well, wait, aren't I making a very well-made art object and trying to sell it to you?
Yeah.
Like it would be ridiculous for me to vilify. And I find when modern artists do that, it kind of reeks. You know what I mean? It
totally
feels really wooden. And then reifying it, I'm also not doing that because it's like, it is what it is. And sometimes designer stuff is tacky and sometimes it's super cool. Sometimes it's like the expression. I mean, I love Alessandro Michele. I love what he's doing.
Me too.
I think he's like a real artist. I love Tom Brown is amazing. Yeah. So like these people are very creative. They're artists.
Totally. And,
like,
and craft is important and paying for it shouldn't be scoffed at.
The alternative right now is like fast fashion. You're like, and then you're just contributing to a lot of waste in the world, and that stuff is made in like terrible conditions. So I guess maybe you thrift is a good thing, but it's hard to know what's right, you know. I mean, I just got an electric car and then I read this article about how bad it is for like how to make the batteries, and I'm just like,
you can't win.
Like, what am I supposed to do?
And then you're scrolling through Instagram and you see Alessandro like knitting and crocheting in quarantine. And you're like, oh, maybe I should buy something from Gucci.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I should just drop the $5,000 on a pair of pants or whatever.
I thought this concept was so interesting that I was reading in your bio. Paintings of expensive things are themselves expensive things collected by the wealthy to promote the luxury lifestyle. What was your relationship and your interest in money and luxury growing up? Was that something that just kind of came when you started exploring the art market, or how did that come about?
No, I mean, I think that comes from, I think my whole life has probably always been this juxtaposition, this paradox, because I grew up in like, I don't know, I guess a middle class, sometimes lower, sometimes higher, depending on how my business was doing, I guess. Where we're like, we were okay. My two older brothers were like really into kind of like rap culture. And at the time in the 90s, I think things have kind of piled on top of each other and all mixed together now, which is awesome in this post-internet world. But at the time in the 90s, even early 80s, you kind of had to choose. Were you like an NWA fan who wore like the 8-ball jacket and like spent money on clothes? Or were you me who was the kind of like anti-capitalist, like I'll just wear sweatpants and like a jean jacket and listen to metal and get into like political punk stuff, but all the while still being in the suburbs with my brothers and my dad driving like a decent car and stuff. So I've lived in this paradox my whole life. Mm. And I see both sides. I wasn't like, ugh, like screw the rest of my family. Like I got there, I got that perspective. I got why my brother liked nice things.
Yeah.
And maybe secretly I liked them too in some way, but I didn't want to be capitalist or something. It's a, you know, it kind of comes back to that whole like, how do you know what to do? What's right? I don't know. Buying an electric car right? Or is the battery bad? I don't know. And then growing up in the punk scene, and it's like this very like fear of selling out thing in the 90s. It was like, don't make money off what you do because then it's not authentic anymore sort of thing. So kind of the intersection of art and money has always been something in the forefront of like, no matter what I've done.
Mm. When there is that focus, where does the concept of soul fit in to the work?
Good question. I mean, I think soul is in there, whether it's sold for an amount of money or not. Like, that's the one thing I've learned along the way is that like, I can still put my heart and soul into work and it can still be appreciated by like a lot of people rather than like an esoteric small amount of people. And it can still look pretty. I think something I maybe misinterpreted in my 20s was that like hard to enjoy equals more depth.
Mm, yeah.
So you'd almost like make things harder you make them uglier, like anti-aesthetic, in order to have people be like, oh, I don't like this. And you're like, yeah, that's because it's awesome and you don't get it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like this trick to try to make it look like it has more to it. But really, it's more something you're doing, I think, out of fear of like really putting yourself out there. I think in hindsight of like my anti-pop, anti-capitalist background, looking back, I was afraid. And people like Bieber or something, that, you know how much guts it takes to be like, I want to be like a pop star, the biggest pop star in the world. Like,
yeah.
I want millions and millions of people to know me and talk shit about me and like throw stuff at me. Like, I can't go out and try a skateboard trick without it being filmed and everyone making fun of my one attempt at a heel flip or whatever. Like, that takes so much courage, in my opinion.
Especially if you're Canadian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, especially when you're brought up Canadian. And so I think what I was doing by like trying to obscure music and making it a bit harder to enjoy and making it harder to see the shows, or it feels a bit like cowardly to me in hindsight. I mean, I'm proud of a lot of the work I've done. I'm not trying to be like everything I've done before, this is bullshit, but I wish that I had had the courage to be like, I want to make things people like.
Yeah.
And it can still have soul. If I do that.
Yeah.
In fact, it could probably have more soul because I'm not trying to rely on this like esoteric obscurity thing, like faux soul.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're starting a bigger conversation when you're trying to communicate.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I think I was afraid to be in the biggest conversation.
Yeah.
I was having little side conversations with my like 10 friends over here and making fun of the big conversation, being like, oh, that whole thing is bullshit. Like, no, it's not. I can't write Wrecking Ball.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's all
a
masterpiece. I mean, yeah, it's absurd to think that that's like lower art. It's
Or people call Shakespeare like a cliche, but it's all a cliche because it's so freaking amazing that we have all read it and focused on it as, you know, as a culture, however long later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How would you describe your database of influences now? What are you most influenced by?
I'm the most influenced, I guess, as far as like artists go. I like the kind of like, I still like the Shit Disturber artists, you know? I mean, I like the Richard Princes and the Warhols. I like people who play with culture and copyright and appropriation and value. And, you know, I'm still a prankster at heart, I think. So I get more out of reading an article about Richard Prince than I do about looking at a David Hockney painting, even though I love Hockney and like on an aesthetic level, obviously I love his work and it inspires me. but it's not what I think about in the studio.
Right.
I think about concepts more than I think about aesthetics, for sure.
Which is an interesting statement, because your work is such a specific aesthetic.
Yeah, totally. But I think once that kind of aesthetic, it's almost like the aesthetic runs itself. It's kind of hard to describe, but you kind of like...
You're not thinking about it.
I'm not thinking about it.
Intentionally anymore.
No, it just does it. It's sort of like the paintings kind of paint themselves now. It's kind of hard to describe, but
right.
There's sort of like a reaction to each color. Like I start and I'm like, okay, well, his nose is turquoise. So that means the cheek needs to be something that's going to react to the turquoise in a nice way. Okay, so I'll make it, you know, rosy pink.
And then you're back to like looking at your socks as a kid and matching the colors next to each other.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, speaking about aesthetics, let's talk about your Versace collaboration, because that seems like such a perfect partnership aesthetically for you. That was spring 2020, right? How did that come about?
So they contacted me on Instagram. I thought it was a hoax, because it wasn't from the Versace Instagram account. It was from like one of the guys that works there.
He slid into your DMs?
Slid into my DMs. Straight up. Yeah. In the past, I had painted paintings of Versace shirts.
Okay.
So I think I was on their radar. So they contacted me and said, like, they're doing this thing for Salone di Mobile, which is like...
Yep.
Okay.
In Milan.
And so they wanted to collaborate with me. They were doing their exhibit that year, which I guess was 2019. They were doing their exhibit at Via Gesù, like the actual Versace... I don't even know if you call it a mansion. It's not the mansion in Miami. It's like his house, and it's kind of like the factory. A lot of the stuff is made there. It's right in the middle of Milan in the fashion area there. And they did their exhibit in the house instead of like at a tent, you know, on the grounds of the fair. So they wanted to work with a few visual artists to like get it looking kind of, you know, modern and fun. So I went in there and brought some paintings. I just happened to be working on a show in New York that was just coming down right when Salone started. So we were able to ship the paintings over there, basically restage the paintings. And believe it or not, when they first reached out to me, I was working on this like 12-foot sculpture of a Versace shirt, completely coincidentally. It was the most serendipitous thing. I was like, you're not even going to believe what I'm working on right now. And so that showed in New York and then was shipped to Via Gesù and like hung in the archway open at like the foyer of it, which was completely amazing.
You manifested it.
I mean, that one really did feel like I just made that happen for sure. And then from there, I met some of the actual clothing designers. I was working more with the furniture people because that's like what the Salone exhibit was. But through just some dinners and stuff, I met some of the designers. And then they suggested we do like a collab. We worked together for like a year on it, and it walked the runway for the spring 2020 show.
Was that just such a trip?
It was surreal. I still can't believe it happened. I mean, they took like one of the drawings of a car that I did and like turned it into like the centerpiece of the runway. It was like this giant model car that was like my drawing. It was like spinning and filled with flowers. You know, I met Donatella. We went to the after party. I went to Milan like four times that year. I went to the runway show before that one. And it was like finding myself in like, you know, the same room as Kendall Jenner. It was like,
yeah,
very bizarre. It was a very bizarre, quick. It happened so quick. And I still am processing it.
Yeah.
And then it came out in stores like, you know, spring 2020, right, like literally right when COVID hit. Actually, the last thing I did before lockdown, which is March 13th here in LA, was go to the Versace store and pick up all of the stuff. Because in my contract, one of the things I got was one of everything.
Oh,
and
my
so
gosh.
I got to do this like Pretty Woman style shopping spree in Versace. And it was the very last, the next day, the city was closed. It was the last thing I did.
That is like the most incredible memory from what life used to be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess I peaked.
Right?
Yeah, I was basically like, just take anything you want. It was like a very like, it was pretty surreal. The whole thing, they've been so cool. Like such an awesome team of people to work with. I maintained a very close friendship with a few of them. Donatella was cool as fuck. I mean, she was, yeah, she's a queen, man. It was really cool to meet her. I did a photo shoot with her. They've treated me so well, flew me out like first class. I mean, I'd never been treated like that in my life.
Yeah.
It was absolutely incredible.
Awesome. And you worked with Moschino too, right?
No. So just like how I was working on that 10-foot Versace shirt sculpture before they contacted me, I'm interested in appropriation. So
yes. Okay.
Make sculptures of all sorts of luxury garments for this show that's opening tomorrow.
Masterpieces.
Yeah. So it has a lot of garment sculptures in it. There's a Moschino thing. There's a Vivienne Westwood thing. I'm basically making sculptures of garments where the garment appropriated fine art, like art history.
Right.
There's a Moschino sweatshirt, like the hoodie zip up thing that has these kind of like cherub motif all over it. So I'm kind of trying to play with this like double appropriation, you know, like putting the designer thing back in the gallery as an art piece, instead of it being like the gift shop, the secondary thing, I'm putting it back into like the original thing, if that makes sense. And just playing with appropriation, like how many more times can I appropriate? Like what? I love this idea of like, because I do like the Patrons Home series too, which is that I paint the interiors of my patrons. So I get to paint my painting twice and show where it went and honor the sale, you know, in a way. And then I can do a patron's home of that patron's home. It can go on forever. What's that effect called?
I can't remember. When it's the photo and the photo and the photo.
Yeah,
and the photo.
Yeah. It was like, I was just watching like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or something like that. And it was one of the questions. And it's like from a product. Some product was the first thing to do it. I forget, a bottle of something. And they're the first person because the person is holding a picture that has the bottle in it. And then that bottle has the person holding the bottle again. And the effect is named after whatever brand that was that did it first. I forget what it is, but anyway. And it kind of comes down to that Kaufman influence. I mean, that's Charlie Kaufman's whole thing. It's like a tunnel of self-references. It just goes on forever.
I don't fully understand what meta is whenever people say that, but I feel like that has a place in all of this.
It's definitely meta. So I think the common, I'm not an academic, but the common misconception is that meta means something in another thing. That's what always people say. It's like a story within a story, but that's not true. Meta is when the art form is aware of itself.
Mm.
So in metafiction, it'll be like the characters of the book suddenly realize that they are characters in a book.
Got it.
Yeah, that's essentially what meta means. So adaptation was the ultimate meta movie because it's like a movie about Charlie Kaufman getting the assignment for a movie. He's trying to write the movie, and that is the movie. I love that. I just love it.
I need to go watch Adaptation. Oh, yeah. I watched it a million years ago. I need to go rewatch it as soon as I get off. So within all of this, what kind of conversations, now that you're a part of this great conversation, are you hoping that your art ignites?
I think I like the conversation to be about pop culture and why people think it's cheaper or like easier. The myth of like writing Wrecking Ball is easy, like anyone could do it, and it's way more interesting to make a Modest Mouse song or whatever the fuck. Yeah, I'm interested in almost like, it's almost like the vilification of pop culture, which I find very strange and personal because I totally used to do it. I'm interested in like coming to terms with that within myself, like why did I not like Britney Spears, which is like a touchy subject now with the whole New York Times thing. So I mean, but that's a perfect example. Like, I mean,
yeah,
it's easier to dogpile on people than, it's so much easier at like a party when you're meeting someone to say you don't like something than you like something. It makes you look so much more interesting, and I hate that.
It says a lot about us.
It does. Yeah, I hate it. I don't like when I meet somebody and their first thing is to just talk about the things they hate. It takes so much more guts to talk about the things you like.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to put yourself out there.
Totally.
What do you feel like has been your biggest challenge creatively?
I mean, the whole thing is a big challenge. I mean, 10 years of abject poverty is a challenge.
That'll do it.
I'm trying to figure out how to survive is a challenge. I guess there's a challenge in like knowing what you want to say, but not knowing how to say it yet.
Mm.
You know, trying to figure out your vernacular, the language that you want to express yourself in. I had all these ideas. I grew up in a certain way. I know what I wanted to say about culture, but I just didn't know how to say it yet. So, yeah, you know, that's a challenge for sure. Just developing the tools and the language.
Totally. And based on that, what are you most excited about to explore?
I mean, I just want to keep going with what I'm doing, you know? I mean, I think I've opened this door to this relationship with art and money. And not that I'm the first person to ever do it, but I think I'm taking it to places people haven't done it before. And I just want to keep doing that.
Awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Awesome. All right. I better get to the gallery.
So. Have a great day. Nice to chat.
Yeah, you too.
And that, beautiful people, concludes this episode of The Inspirati. I hope you picked up some inspiration to take into your day. Please rate, review, subscribe, and leave a comment if you're enjoying these conversations. You can follow The Inspirati on Instagram or find me at alex.merrill. Stay inspired and keep creating. The world needs it more than ever.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.